Burma has been ruled for decades by a military junta that is one of the world's most repressive and secretive. It's also been beset for decades with a violent ethnic conflict that has claimed an untold number of lives. In For Us, Surrender is Out of the Question, journalist Mac McClellan chronicles not only the history of the troubled Southeast Asian nation, but also recounts her time with members of the group Burma Action, a U.S.-designated terrorist organization. Her book is published by Soft Skull, and I'm very pleased that it brings Mac McClellan to our underreported segment today. Hi.
Hi.
Before we get started, you refer to the country as Burma. On maps, it's now Myanmar. Are you making a political statement by choosing to call the country Burma?
I am. Well, I'm carrying the political statement that other people are making.
But isn't Myanmar really closer to the name the people gave it before the British came in and called it Burma?
Well, Burma is actually a sort of a, Bama is a sort of a lazy pronunciation of the original name, and it's kind of the colloquial name, so it's not, a lot of people do think that it's the British who came in and called it Burma, but that's not actually the case, and all the democracy activists there insist on calling it Burma to refuse to acknowledge the junta's right to change it to Myanmar, so.
You write, I'm quoting, "I wasn't connected to any aid or charity organization. I just happened on a website of a group that said it was promoting democracy in the Texas-sized military dictatorship of Burma and eventually volunteered via email to help its activists living in Thailand learn English." That seems like a pretty big jump to take. What had you been doing before you decided to look at that website?
I actually was, the first time I saw the website was in 2004. I was going on vacation to Thailand and a bunch of Southeast Asian nations for several months before I went to grad school, and I saw something about this huge refugee crisis, and I couldn't find any easy or satisfactory information about why the hell there was this huge refugee crisis, hundreds of thousands, and that's not the sort of thing that you ever hear about. And it was sort of haunting me throughout grad school. And when I came back to it after I graduated, it was the same story, except worse, and there was still no information about it. And so I just went to check it out.
Had you even heard of the Karen people when you arrived in Thailand?
I had read about Karen people. Well, because they're
You thought you were working with Koreans.
Yeah. Well, when you see it on paper, it's spelled just K-A-R-E-N, which looks like Karen. And the woman who picked me up from the airport, who was Thai and very soft-spoken and very heavily accented, kept saying this word to me that I was going to see these people. There were going to be all these Koreans. I was going to work with these Koreans. But, of course, she was saying Karen, and I was just misunderstanding her.
Well, there are a lot of different ethnic groups in Burma, aren't there?
Sure.
Is this a result of colonialism where the British would just lump everybody in a region together?
There were actually a lot of ethnic groups in Burma always. A lot of people tried to take over it. A lot of tribes moved in from various other countries. So regardless of where those lines had been drawn, there would have been it would have been a very diverse nation.
And have ethnic tensions driven the conflict in Burma in the past, or is that just something that's happened more recently?
There were definitely ethnic tensions before. The majority Burmese have been, you know, they've had pockets of ethnic chauvinism for a long time. It was certainly exacerbated when the British came in and decided to favor a bunch of other ethnic groups over the Burmese and use them in their colonial administration and give them a bunch of benefits that they weren't giving to the majority.
Is that what happened with the Karen? Were they among the favored groups?
Oh, yeah. The British loved the Karen. They had them in the police. They had them in the military. They used them as nannies. They had them be spies against the Burmese, and then the Karen fought for the Allies during World War II. So they were definitely a very Western-friendly minority group.
Partly because a large portion of them had been converted to Christianity.
Yeah, that was one of the reasons why the British thought that they were so reliable, was because the missionaries had so much success with them in the hills, and the Karen were, you know, happy to embrace Christianity because they saw it as a way to get literacy and, you know, sort of a higher civilization that they didn't have access to before. Their language had only been oral. They didn't, you know, they didn't have anything written. So it was a good education opportunity for them.
Where are these groups located? Where are the Karen located?
Well, they're all over Burma. There are a bunch in the lowlands and in the cities. the war is staged mostly in the eastern hills, right along the border with Thailand.
Mm-hmm. And that's why so many of the refugees are in Thailand.
Right. Well, it's also there's also a bunch in India. There's also a bunch in Malaysia. They pretty much run away to whatever border is closest for them, wherever they happen to be when they're attacked.
Now, what are they fighting over? Did the Karen fight for independence, or is the junta going after them as a form of ethnic cleansing?
Well, it started as a fight for independence. I mean, they were independent in 1948 from the British, and within months, civil war had erupted on several fronts. The Karen National Union declared war in 1949. So
this is when Burma was considered a better country, when U Thant was running the UN,
right.
A Burmese diplomat.
That's right. People sort of thought it was the great promising star of Southeast Asia. But as I said, it erupted into war almost immediately. And the Karen War was the most threatening of those wars. Because they had been so favored by the Allies, they were trained by the British. They were given weapons by the British and by the Americans. So they actually had a lot of promise as a group to take over the country. And they actually almost did originally. You know, back in the 50s, they came just outside the capital and they almost took it. And if they had, it'd probably be a different story today. But they eventually ended up pushed back to the hills.
But it also would have meant minority rule, wouldn't it? The Karen are far from the majority group in Burma.
That's true, but it wasn't as though the Karen were trying to impose Karen rule all over the country. They were one of many ethnic groups that just wanted autonomy. So they wanted to foster the sort of rule where all the other ethnic groups could also be autonomous.
My guest is Mac McClelland. Her book For Us, Surrender is Out of the Question, a story from Burma's never-ending war. It is published by Soft Skull Press. That title comes from a motto of the Karen?
Yeah, it's the first tenet of their revolution, and you can see it written and printed and tattooed on everything.
I'm still a bit confused. If the Karen were pushing for independence, why then are we talking in terms of genocide? Hasn't the Genocide Prevention Task Force, which is headed by former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright, listed Burma as part of the genocide watch list?
That's right. As if being watched is useful in any way to people who are the victims of a genocide.
Well, at least we're counting.
That's right. They are... You're right. It started as a struggle for independence, and as retaliation, the junta has waged this war against them. The Karen refused to give up. Nobody can, you know, meet in the middle on terms of what they want. They want autonomy. They're not going to get it. So because this war has been going on for so long, in order to defeat them, they just started eliminating them.
Well, how is this all that different from what's happening in Darfur?
Well, the thing is that in a lot of ways, it's not that different from what's happening in Darfur or what was, you know, that situation has gotten a lot better recently than it was. But that's sort of the thing is that you have the same sort of horrors. You have government, but these are actual government troops, not just government sponsored troops, actual government soldiers coming in, burning down villages, killing people, raping people. And there is tons of documentation. There are photos, videos, interviews, just endless piles of it. But it just doesn't get the same attention.
Well, the international pressure probably played some role in Sudan, at least cooling things in Darfur.
Absolutely.
But haven't people been condemning Burma or Myanmar for quite a while now?
You do, but the thing that you hear about Burma is it's sort of a vaguely bad place. There's some sort of oppression and censorship and, you know, they need to vote, this sort of thing. That's the kind of stuff that you hear about, political prisoners, and all that is really bad.
A guy swims across a lake and winds up causing all sorts of trouble.
Sure, right. They have a Nobel Peace laureate who's, you know, basically been under house arrest for most of the last 20 years. That is the sort of thing that you hear about. You do not hear about the ethnic cleansing that's going on in the hills, and that is the sort of story that, like Darfur, would actually probably mobilize people toward actually trying to force politicians to take some sort of action to address it.
Several human rights groups, including Watchlist, have documented the use of child soldiers in Burma. Don't both sides use child soldiers?
Well, the Karen have committed to the United Nations to not use child soldiers anymore. They haven't had a lot of reports. And also an important difference between the insurgents having child soldiers is that they, I don't know how much better this makes it, but at least those children volunteered, whereas the junta will just conscript kids off the street. Like, you could be standing at a bus stop and a soldier will come along and now you're in the army and that's it. So, yeah, you think that a lot of people would think that the country with the most child soldiers in the world would be somewhere in Africa, but it's Burma.
Are child soldiers rehabilitated back into society?
In
Burma?
Well,
because that's a big issue in...
Sure.
Well, right now, of course, they're still being used, but in some of the African countries where there have been child soldiers in the past, those lives have been lost for all intents and purposes. It's very hard to get them back into society.
Sure. Well, a lot of children who people have been able to interview, you know, Human Rights Watch and Amnesty and things like that, are kids who escaped from the junta, and then sometimes they can go back to their families, but sometimes they can't because they will be found there. But you don't have the same sort of thing where they end up forming these, you know, roving gangs of, you know, kids who can't be integrated back into society. And for the most part, you know, in the ethnic insurgencies, they just go back and join their villages.
There also have been reports of forced labor in Burma, of human trafficking.
Yeah, it's always listed as one of the places with the biggest human trafficking problem. And forced labor.
Is the junta actually engaging in that human practice of trafficking, or just looking the other way?
I think it's probably, well, certainly members of the junta. It's not, you know, top-down sort of ordered, but there are definitely soldiers and government-related people involved in the kickbacks from that trade, for sure. But forced labor is not a rare thing. It's an everyday part of life for the civilians there.
Isn't part of the problem that Burma's neighbors aren't willing to really crack down on it because they all are gaining something from this?
Yeah, well, that's part of the problem with our sanctions, actually, is that Burma's neighbors will not implement them themselves. So
that's what, China, Thailand? Whatever.
China, Thailand, and India are big-time trading partners with Burma. And so Burma doesn't really care if the United States doesn't want to buy its stuff anymore because those other countries will be happy to have it.
And what is Burma supplying?
Gas. They have a lot of gas. They also have a lot of gems and a lot of jewelry that they just end up, so in theory they can't sell it to the United States, but it goes to Thailand and China, and that's where we get our jewelry anyway. So they actually have a lot of really, really valuable resources.
Well, teak, some great woods, but
that's
also
right.
Jade, I gather.
That's right.
It's always been the source of jade for the Chinese because there's very little jade in China, but
mm-hmm.
jade was so highly prized throughout the history of China.
That's right.
What were the conditions like at Burma Action's compound when you arrived there?
The conditions were not totally unlike a frat house, frankly. You know, it's a bunch of mid-20s guys who work really hard, and granted their job is a lot more dangerous than most people's jobs, but then when they come home, you know, they like to relax and drink cheap Thai beer and watch TV and play on the computer.
And you write about that first experience, saying, I couldn't have guessed then, drifting to sleep to the sound of their amiable chatter, that every last one of them was a terrorist.
Yeah. They're really nice terrorists, though. They
who's classified them as a terrorist group?
It was the State Department has had, via the Patriot Act, you know, inserted a clause about what's something called material support. So basically, if you have any relations to any terrorist groups, if you help them, if you know them, if you give a terrorist, you know, a glass of water, then you are by association a terrorist too. So because these guys either had been soldiers in the Karen National Union, or their dads were soldiers, their brothers were soldiers, they all worked with the Karen National Union for their job, and the Karen National Union was a tier 3 terrorism group classified by the State Department. It has since been delisted, but at that time.
I was wondering why it was called a terrorist group, considering the fact the United States would like to see the junta toppled.
Sure. It's weird, right? Because we hate Burma, and everybody knows that we hate Burma. But it is technically a, you know, official UN-recognized state government, and these guys were guerrillas, and they were fighting an insurrection. So they fell under the very loose definition of Tier 3 terrorism, which, you know, pretty much if you and I both got guns, we would fall into that category as well. Well,
the group isn't really called Burma Action. Why did you change its name?
Because they wouldn't let me talk about it for the safety of the people who were there, and after talking with them, it was the right thing to do. They would have been thrown out of Thailand, because it's illegal to employ refugees, it's illegal to have refugees living outside refugee camps, it's illegal to have them crossing the border, so it was for the protection of the group.
Aren't they also engaged in certain illegal activities? Just all of these insurrections, to some degree, rely on selling gems or other things that they shouldn't be doing.
Sure.
That's how they pay their way.
Right, with smuggling. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's how the Korean National Union for a long time had a lot of money, and the way that they were getting it was they controlled, you know, huge pieces of the border between Burma and Thailand where a lot of black market goods were flowing. So
my guest is Mac McClelland, whose book for us, Surrender is Out of the Question, a story from Burma's never-ending war. It's published by Soft Skull Press. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Mac McClelland, McClelland. Her book for us, Surrender is Out of the Question, a story from Burma's never-ending war, published by Soft Skull Press. How many refugees from Burma are estimated to be living in refugee camps in Thailand?
About 150,000.
And are there also internal camps, camps within Burma, or everybody outside now?
There are well more than 500,000 inside who are displaced just on the Burma side of the Thai-Burma border as well. That's even a way bigger problem than the refugees.
And what are the conditions like? I imagine they're horrific.
They are horrific. The Burmese jungle is one of the most treacherous tracts of geography on the planet, as many different conquering countries could tell you. I mean, when the British first showed up, they were slayed by malaria and all sorts of tropical diseases. Tigers, they have plants there that if you rub up against them, you can get a rash that can eventually kill you. I mean, there are all sorts of
The Japanese were stopped in Burma as well.
They were, and the Allies, we had to evacuate a ton of Chinese who were just falling sick left and right. So, yeah, we couldn't have grown men, soldiers survive there, but now there are hundreds of thousands of kids basically living in the same conditions.
And they're crossing through that into Thailand. Does Burma have any border guards?
They do, but that is a long border, you know. This is like our border. You just can't have people watching it the whole way.
And what happens when they go to Thailand? Are they welcomed?
Not so much.
Well, who's paying for the camps in Thailand?
We are paying for some of it. Western governments pay for it, and we chip in actually the biggest piece of the aid there. But other than that, they are entirely fed by an organization that is Christian and raises money from other Christians. They've long been taken care of by Christians because the Thais don't really want to have anything to do with them.
Can they leave the camps and get a job in local communities?
No. The camps have guards, but the purpose of the guards is not to keep people out, but to keep the refugees in, because they are not actually recognized as refugees by Thailand.
Because Thailand is compromised by its relations with Burma and the junta.
That's part of it. But even when these refugees started arriving, you know, 20 years ago, when Thailand and Burma were still very openly adversarial toward each other. But, you know, poor Thailand, they are a neutral safe space for a lot of other conflicts. So they had Vietnamese refugees. They had Laotian refugees. They just didn't want any more.
How difficult is it for human rights and humanitarian organizations to get into Burma? We keep on hearing it. They've opened it up for a little while, and then they close it, and then they open it.
Sure. Well, part of that is that they're talking about the main parts of this in the main cities and things like that.
Including the new one that they've just built.
Right, the new capital. They will occasionally extend visas to, you know, Red Cross workers, and then they'll arbitrarily kick them out or they'll hold them up at airports. But as far as the eastern part where this war and this genocide are raging, nobody is allowed in there. And so you have all these internally displaced people, more than the entire country of Afghanistan, just packed into this little piece of Burma. There's no Red Cross there. There's no Mercy Corps there. Nobody can get in there. And so no one has responsibility for aiding these incredibly stressed populations.
How does information about them even get out?
Well, that's what the guys who I lived with did. They would sneak back and forth over the border, and they would walk around with a backpack full of socks and video cameras basically for several months at a time, and they would interview people. Sometimes they would be in the villages when they got attacked, so there's footage of soldiers coming in and burning villages down and women screaming and running for their lives. And if they don't get caught, then they bring the footage back over into Thailand.
Doesn't the junta run something like a socialist economy?
Well, everything is state-owned, for sure. And if it's not owned by the state, then it's owned by very close friends of the state.
Well, how did that happen? After World War II, mm-hmm. Burma became one of the darlings of the American government, didn't it, as a bulwark against communism?
Yeah.
The Truman and the Eisenhower administrations flooded the country with weapons and pretty much train the government's military.
That's right. For a hot second, we were trying to keep them, if not, you know, not becoming super allied with China. We just didn't want them. At least we wanted them to stay neutral. If it would be better if they were, you know, going to be capitalists. But actually, at the same time that we were sending all that money and all those weapons to their government, the CIA was also running their first secret war. In northern Burma, they had a proxy force of Chinese nationalists, and the Burmese government.
This is while Mao was moving ahead, and some
right.
of Chiang Kai-shek's forces were living in northern Burma.
That's right. It was Chiang Kai-shek's forces, the KMT, and so the CIA was sort of orchestrating this thing and funding this thing. And Burma knew that we were doing that, and they asked the United States to desist, and we just pretended like we had no idea what they were talking about. And the paranoia that we instilled in them because of that invasion was actually part of the reason why they started clamping down after the military took control. So they thought that in order to avoid that sort of incursion on their borders, they were going to have to be a military state, and everything, including all the businesses and the banks and everything else, were going to have to be run by generals.
Aren't some members of the KMT still active, or at least the descendants of them, in Burma?
Yeah, well, a lot of them became drug dealers, and you're right, that lineage is still definitely alive and well.
A listener wonders whether the Karen are also involved in the opium trade, because we're talking about the Golden Triangle.
Sure. This is actually a little, most of the Karen territory is actually a little bit south of the Golden Triangle, but the Karen are not. They actually reinvented the Karen National Union a couple decades ago as an extremely Christian leaning organization. All the leaders were Christian. They were eschewing drug use, and if they even had soldiers who were caught using drugs, they forced them into rehab or actually even occasionally executed them.
You write about General Nguyen, who came to power in the late 50s, that like the artistic young Hitler before him, Nguyen hadn't dreamt as a child of destroying millions of lives with gruesomely misguided evil. No, he wanted to be a doctor.
He did.
So what happened?
He flunked his exams.
And
the rest
just
is
simply
history.
That.
Yeah, well, he got a job.
And the system that he set up, because as I mentioned earlier, the first UN Secretary General, U Thant, was from Burma.
That's right.
And he was kind of, his party was kind of displaced, wasn't it, when the junta took over?
Yeah, that's right. And Nguyen had originally been, so he, you know, got a job at the post office. He tried his hand at coal trading for a while. He just couldn't really get successful in any of his business endeavors. He worked his way up in the army until he was the commander-in-chief, and he was actually part of a caretaker government for a little while, and then they had elections, and he was not chosen as the winner, and that's when the junta took over.
In 1966, wasn't he invited to Washington by Lyndon Johnson?
Yeah, he played golf. He really had a good time in Hawaii. Yeah, this was not a guy who we were going to come out and say anything against the horrible things that he was doing to his people, because we really did not want them to become a communist state.
We were entrenched in Vietnam in 1966, yeah. Then Nguyen was replaced by the current leader of the junta, General Tan Shui. Why was he replaced?
Yeah, there have been a few power changes in there. Originally, Nguyen had to step down, or at least pretend like he was stepping down and not having anything to do with the, you know, major political runnings there, because of the protests of 1988, when, you know, tens of thousands of people came out into the street and the military shot and killed a bunch of them, and eventually sort of made peace with the populace by saying, okay, fine, we will give you elections and we'll sort of change the government around. And then, of course, the military lost the elections, and then they said, well, then we're just going to void these elections and they don't count.
Well, that's what they did.
That's
when
right.
They lost the election to Aung San Suu, I always have problems with her name, Suu Kyi, she, right?
That's right. Yeah, it was her party who won by a landslide the majority of the seats in parliament, and so the military dictatorship was just like, no, we're just not going to honor those election results. And that was, she had already actually been under house arrest by that time, and she's, as you know, been under house arrest for most of the time since.
The New York Times wrote today that in Burma, signs of change abound. The military has issued permits for private hospitals and schools, neither of which were officially allowed before. It sold a raft of state-run factories and assets to cronies in the private sector and appears to be lifting some of the punitive restrictions on ownership of cars and motorcycles. The country is taking steps to revive its troubles, resolve its troubles, but potentially lucrative rice exports. To revive its troubled but potentially lucrative rice export. So it's doing things. I guess it's looked to China and said, well, we have to do something. And the Chinese have somehow been able to maintain a relatively tight grip on the country and still free up the economy.
Yeah, I can't tell you what I really think about that, because you can't swear on the radio, but those things that the military is doing right now are, you know, they're having elections coming up later this year, and they have been trying to curry favor with the population to try to get them on board with this elections process, which everyone knows is going to be a huge farce.
And why are they even doing another election if the last one was totally negated?
They promised in 2008 that they were going to have elections because, you know, in 2007 with the Saffron Revolution, when they shot at all those monks, the Western media was all over that. If there's anything that Burma doesn't want, it's media attention. And they do usually manage to stay under the radar. So it was sort of, you know, okay, but we're going to have elections in 2010. We promise everything will be fine if you can just stop paying attention to us right now.
Now, you mentioned they have a lot of natural gas. They also have oil reserves. Mm-hmm. Who are they selling it to?
China, mostly, though India and Thailand. Thailand is pretty dependent on their natural gas. And
there's a pipeline that's being built by the Chinese, isn't there?
Yes, another pipeline is being built by the Chinese. And, you know, Chevron still, in part, operates a pipeline there in one of their biggest gas fields.
Now, why is India not harder on Burma? Because it is a democracy, and it's not, I would think that it would be much less sympathetic with what's going on there.
Well, India is almost as dependent on Burma's exports as China is. Not only do they need their energy, I mean, you know, India is an incredibly populous and energy desperate country, but they also get a lot of their pulses from there. They get a lot of their rice from there. And, you know, ASEAN as a whole, the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, is still trying to play nice with Burma.
The IMF, World Bank officials, and even Joseph Stiglitz have traveled to Burma recently.
That's right.
Yesterday, I spoke with John Kampner about his book, Freedom for Sale, where he argues that democracy and free market capitalism don't always go hand in hand, as some people think they do. Do you think an improved economy in Burma would open the door for democratic reforms?
I do, actually. I think one of the many, many mistakes that we've made in Burma policy was pulling all of our investments out and enacting the sanctions that we have, because without legitimate business interests controlling business in Burma, that just leaves more to the military government to control.
Well, the Burmese constitution, which was passed during Cyclone Nargis, gave the military total immunity, so they can even lose control and live off of all the money that they've made so far. It's been reported this morning that Nyi Aung, a pro-democracy activist and naturalized U.S. citizen, has been released from prison in Burma a month after a court sentenced him to 5 years of hard labor. You think that's a sign that they want to soften relations with the West?
I think it's a sign that they want us to stop talking about it. I don't think that it means that they're going to make any major concessions to curbing their human rights abuses just because they let, you know, one U.S. citizen go.
Did the Cyclone Nargis have an impact on the Karen?
Well, for the most, at least not the Eastern War, because it was mostly in the lowlands. But yeah, I mean, that was so big and so many people died that most of the country was affected in some way, for sure.
Mac McClellan's book is For Us, Surrender is Out of the Question, a story from Burma's never-ending war. It is published by Soft Skull Press, and I want to thank you so much for being with us today on our underreported segment.
Thanks for having me.